Welcome to episode 133 of the Blooms of Barnacles podcast, where we talk about all things written to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Dermot.
And I'm Kelly. How are you today, Dermot?
I am good, thank you.
Okay. Anything new? Any news?
Not really. Huh. No, all going well. Very busy working on freelance and
yeah,
hopefully getting stuff done on the house and be nice.
All right. Ask me what's new with me.
What's new with you, my dear?
I'm working on an exciting new blog post for this website called bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Haven't heard of it.
Oh. It's a great blog as well as podcasts about James Joyce's Ulysses.
Okay.
Yeah, so welcome to anyone if this is your first episode. We are a blog as well as a podcast, and I am hard at work on a new blog post. Should be up in the very near future. Every so often I do one where I analyze an outside piece of poetry that has influenced Ulysses. Which poem am I looking at this time around? It's called The Song of Medical Dick and Medical Davy.
I have to draw a cartoon of this.
I'm so excited to see it. Yeah, we don't have the cartoon yet. As long as it doesn't get banned from social media, it'll be out in the near future. What do you know about Medical Dick and Medical Davy?
It's dirty and filthy. And
yeah.
It should be banned.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's double entendre.
It was described as unprintable by Ulick O'Connor, but luckily somebody did print it. So we have an analysis of that for you. There's actually pretty interesting, you know, incarnations that Medical Dick and Medical Davy have passed through over the years. So keep an eye out for that. I'm very excited to share it with everyone. And Dermot, as you might have guessed, is our resident artist. He's done some artwork for this episode. Would you like to tell the nice people about your artwork?
This is the advert in the Liffey.
That's the advert in the Liffey, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting footnote. And I'm assuming it's something that Joyce saw himself, or it was. It seems like it has the truthiness to it. Where some clever ad man realized that he didn't have to pay billboard money if he had a boat in the Liffey and had an ad on the boat. Mm-hmm. So he's got the advertising billboard on a little rowing boat moored anchored in the Liffey.
Yeah.
And it's for like trousers, 11 shillings trousers, so budget trouser size. So.
Yeah, and I do want to congratulate you, listener, if this is your first episode and you're not already on board the Blooms and Barnacles train, to start with the Kino's 11 shilling trousers episode, where we're going to spend the next hour analyzing Kino's 11 shilling trousers. I thank you for joining us because that must sound very tedious and boring, but it's actually really interesting. And we're going to get into like numerology
and Kabbalah.
The way my mind moves.
Yep.
But are you interested in advertising as a concept?
Oh, yeah. I don't love the industry, but it's an interesting subject to read about and the psychology and the mind fuckery that goes into like warping people's brains.
Okay.
And I remember as a young man reading about one of the most infamous advertising campaigns in history, which was a brand called Strand Cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And this ad was so bad, it tanked the company, put them out of business. And the ad, it sounded great to somebody in the ad room. And it was a man by himself on the train platform smoking a cigarette. And the caption is, "You're never alone with a Strand." And apparently they thought this looks cool, like in a loner kind of way. And the message was only losers smoke Strand cigarettes. Nobody bought them. It was like, you think Bud Light was bad? Like the, it tanked them, and it went down in like at annals of advertising. That's one reason why people who commission ads are terrified, and you can tell that they're like control freakery about it because I'm sure they know this ad goes wrong, it can make or break us, and it could break us as easily as make us a fortune. And one stupid slogan, you know.
All right. Well, let's save some of this because I can see you're actually quite exercised and interested in this topic. So I want to give a couple of shout outs before we get into it a bit further. First of all, thank you to everyone who's donated to keep the ring lights on. You can donate if you like what we're doing over on PayPal or on patreon.com/barnaclecast. PayPal you can use for a one-time donation and Patreon for a recurring monthly subscription. You can find the links to all that in the upper right-hand corner of
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
That's right. If you are supporting us, thank you so much. It really does help. And I've got some exciting stuff I'm doing in the year coming up that being funded by my Patreon. So we'll talk about that when we're ready to cross that bridge. But what we do as a thank you gift to all of our lovely patrons is we make some bonus episodes, and you also get early access to these regular episodes as well as a video version if you want to see what I look like. Our April Patreon bonus we're in the process of working on, but it should be out very, very soon. And it's the fourth episode in our series on James Joyce's Dubliners. And this month we are covering the stories The Boarding House and A Little Cloud. So we're finally getting into some of the good Dubliner stories. We don't have to read After the Race or anything anymore.
Yeah.
The rest of the book's pretty good. It has its ups and downs, I think, in the early ones. I was going to say there's no more child abuse, but no, that's really not true. There's some horrific child abuse. A lot of sad people and sad stories.
Quiet
and
desperation.
Quiet and some loud desperation well. But that, we're not reading Counterparts this month, so we'll come to that. I do have to say one thing I've taken away from this series is a greater appreciation for After the Race, which I know is Joyce's least favorite story in Dubliners, and also my least favorite story in Dubliners. Mm. And one that basically I forget as soon as I finished reading it, but we really learned a lot about the Gordon Bennett race and its place in Irish history. And we got a great comment from our listener Sophie over on Patreon about After the Race. There was one part of it I did want to share far and wide. She mentions Dave in there. Dave is her partner.
They do a heritage run of the original Gordon Bennett race route most years down here in the southeast, by the way. If you're in any way interested in very old cars, it's pretty cool to see them. I'm less interested in Dave's thing, cars, than he is into my thing, Joyce. But even I found it extremely interesting to see all these beautiful century-old machines.
Yep.
So she means the southeast of Ireland, is it?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm assuming, yeah, if you did take a fancy to old-timey race cars and things after that episode, if we ever had a chance, I think it would definitely be a really fun thing to see.
I used to spend a lot of time in Toluca Lake where family used to live in L.A., and Bob's Big Boy Burgers place, the diner on Toluca Lake. Oh, I forget the name of the road. Mm-hmm. But the end of like this last Thursday every month or something, they would have all the classic cars out there.
Okay.
So it was great fun to see. And those guys, like the engines are, you can eat your dinner off them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit of my personal lore too. My parents are very into restoring classic Mustangs. Obviously pretty different from the Gordon Bennett cars, which are more like soapbox derby racers.
Yeah.
But
long cigar ones with the
I would say too, if you're thinking about going to see the recreation, much lower body count.
Health and safety won't allow to kill spectators.
So we'll leave it there. And if you want to keep up with anything else related to Blooms and Barnacles, you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter free at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. And you can follow us on social media. You'll find us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky. Mm. Instagram's the best one, is the best follow, I think. Sometimes I post pictures of my cats there too. So if you want to see the devils that are often disrupting this very podcast, they're actually pretty cute.
They are.
Okay. We are just beginning Ulysses' 8th episode, which is called Lestragonians. We are on pages 152 through 154 this week in my edition of Ulysses, which is the 1990 Vintage International Edition. And Dermot, I was hoping you could give us a quick recap of what happened last week.
Oh,
Elijah is coming!
Oh,
Sunday,
right.
Sunday!
Yeah. Okay. Bloom sees the flyer for the old Elijah, the fake American prophet.
Yep.
Think she's the third Elijah. Mm-hmm. I guess Elijah number one, Jesus is Elijah two, and he's number three.
Yeah, he's number three. It's like Napoleon the third.
Interesting kook. And he founded a city, Zion, in Illinois that still exists, but no longer is a crazy town.
Yeah, we could go visit Zion sometimes when we go see my parents, but it would be very boring, I think.
Yeah.
I took you to Downers Grove. What more do you want?
There must be a local history society with pictures of the temple.
That's true. Okay. All right. Put a pin in that for whenever we're near Chicago next.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to now read you a quote, and I just want you to tell me what you think of this quote. This is from Joyce scholar Daniel Gunn. Mm-hmm. In using advertisements to represent Ulysses, then, Joyce is intentionally degrading the novel, drawing it into the muck of popular culture for comic effect. A trouser advertisement in a rowboat. This is the language of Ulysses.
Hmm.
What do you have any thoughts?
Oh, that's fine.
I just like that quote. I didn't have the space for it anywhere else. So it's pretty easy for us to, you know, get very pompous and exegesis on the great state of the modernist novel. But at some point you are just reading about trousers on a rowboat.
Yeah.
And that's great. This is not an insult to anyone or anything. I like that there is a pretty steady stream of lowbrow stuff in Ulysses. Mm. I just think we keep
it's a bit
that
like,
in our head.
It's a bit like classic Simpsons that way.
Yeah.
And I mean that seriously. Like there's jokes in the Simpsons that you go, oh my God, that was... Mm-hmm.
Let's get into Ulysses.
Looking down, he saw flapping strongly, wheeling between the gaunt quay walls, gulls. Rough weather outside. If I threw myself down... Reuben J. Son must have swallowed a good bellyful of that sewage. One and eightpence too much? It's the droll way he comes out with the things. Knows how to tell a story too.
Okay, what do you take away from that?
Oh, I know this one from the. We've done this before.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's looking into the filthy river.
Yep.
And it says gulls, rough weather outside. One thing seagulls do when they come in, and it usually means the sea's a bit choppy. I threw myself down, so he's thinking about jumping in the water. Reuben J., his son, allegedly tries to commit suicide and gets fished out of the liffey.
I like that you said allegedly so that his ghost doesn't come and sue us.
They're the worst lawsuits when the ghosts come after you. So he swallowed
ghost
the
law in this country.
The liffey is an open sewer, right? Like the liffey swim every year. You lads are swimming in sewage. Like, I don't know about today, but God almighty, the Jack B. Yeats painting the liffey swim. Like, so would you stop? You couldn't get hepatitis. One and eightpence too much. So Reuben J. Senior was paid one and eightpence. He paid one and eightpence to the man who rescued his son. So the joke was that's how much he valued his son's life.
Whose joke was that?
Joyce's joke, or
it was one generation back.
Left wing newspaper, wasn't there?
It was Simon Dedalus who made that comment in the carriage in
Hades.
He spent a half crown. And he says one and eightpence too much.
Right. But it was quoted in like a one of the lefty newspapers of the
time.
Was
it a Florin? Doesn't matter. Yes. Yeah. And that's our first-hand source for
So that's why we know like it was actual, like this is a thing. Like,
It was going around.
It's not just completely made up or anything.
Bloom here in within the context of the novel is remembering Simon Dedalus.
In the carriage to Glasnevin. Right. Telling
them. I think we've just went past the part two where he'd seen Dilly Dedalus outside of Dylan's auction house selling the family's furniture so they can pay for their gruel. Mm-hmm. And so now he's moved on to Simon Dedalus.
Yeah.
And gulls. Look, if you're in current day Dublin, the gulls are, I would say, an omnipresence. And we remarked back in Proteus how it's weird there are no gulls. Mm-hmm. And we got a really nice response to that from a gull expert. And I don't know which episode that is in. The gulls finally make themselves known. If you're not from Ireland or you've never spent time in Dublin, that is not the experience of being in Dublin.
Go to Stephen's Green.
They are a constant presence and they will rob you blind.
There's a go to YouTube and do a search for a seagull, Grafton Street crisps. And it walks right into a shop like he owns it and walks out with a bag of crisps in his mouth and rips it open and starts eating them. And the guy filming is cracking up laughing. Yeah. And he said, I'll pay for the crisps because he enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, when we lived near Dublin, I taught international students and we would go on outings to Stephen's Green. And I said, you can get ice cream on the way. I said, but keep it close to your body because the gulls will rob it from your hand.
Yeah.
And we had a great experience with a class full of international students by the lagoon there. A woman a little too free with that ice cream and a gull came down and just take out it. Of her hand and took it away. And they, as one went, oh, and I was like, you didn't believe me, but now you do.
Yeah.
Okay.
They wheeled lower, looking for grub. Wait. He threw down among them a crumpled paper ball. Elijah, 32 feet per sec, is calm. Not a bit. The ball bobbed unheeded on the wake of swells, floated under by the bridge piers. Not such damn fools. Also the day I threw that stale cake at the Erin's King, picked it up in the wake 50 yards astern. Live by their wits, they wheeled, flapping.
So he's thinking about gulls. Anything else you pull out of there?
So he's flipping the Elijah is coming.
Yeah, he crumples it up. 32 feet per second is the acceleration due to gravity.
Okay. Per sec is calm. What is calm?
Elijah is coming.
Was coming. Okay. Yeah. Per second is coming. Okay. Jesus. Not a bit. So they're not touching the ball. They know it's not food.
Yeah.
They can tell the difference between paper and cake. So, yeah. And then he's remembering a previous stale cake, which they ate. So,
Yes. Which was, he remembers going on an outing on the Erin's King back in Calypso.
On the Erin's King that day around the Kish. Damned old tub pitching about. Not a bit funky. Her pale blue scarf loosened the wind with her hair.
Yeah, he's remembered Millie being out on the boat.
Okay.
So I've come a memory attached to both Millie and Millie's independence. Mm-hmm. And by extension, Molly, because Millie and Molly are becoming more alike as time goes by.
The hungry famished gull flaps o'er the waters dull. That is how poets write. The similar sounds. But then Shakespeare has no rhymes. Blank verse. The flow of the language it is. The thoughts solemn. Hamlet, I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain time to walk the earth. Bit meta there, do you think? When he's saying the flow of the languages, like Joyce is saying, my language is pretty good too, you know? It's the flow, not the rhyme.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thoughts, like it's the internal monologue.
Yep. Yeah. So Bloom is trying his hand at a bit of artistry and poetry here. Mm-hmm. Echoes Little Chandler, who we'll be discussing in this month's bonus episode.
Yeah.
That was when I was going through these notes that really jumped out to me.
Yeah.
We'll get into it more in the little cloud discussion, but this is a very parallel situation of him just walking through Dublin, writing poetry. Although Bloom is more engaged with his surroundings, I would say. Mm-hmm. Little Chandler's like stepping over people in the street, thinking yeah. about what a great poet he's going to be. And I believe, and I didn't write a note down, but I believe he does botch this Shakespeare quote as well. I'm sure someone
okay.
listening with more Shakespeare knowledge than me will comment if I get that wrong or if I get it right. We'd love to know your thoughts. The thoughts, we want them. Send them our way. I would just say keep this bit in mind, Bloom's little gull poem here. Bloom has this poetic impulse and we will kind of return to that idea that this is something that kind of moves through his mind. Your best Moore Street impression there.
I used to be able to sort of do a Dublin accent. Mm-hmm. 2 apples a penny, 2 for a penny.
That's offensive.
That's cultural appropriation. His gaze passed over the glazed apples serried on her stand. Australians they must be this time of year. Shiny peels, polishes them up with a rag or a handkerchief. Wait, those poor birds. He halted again and bought from the old apple woman 2 Banbury cakes for a penny and broke the brittle paste and threw its fragments down into the liffey. See that? The gulls swooped silently too, then all from their heights, pouncing on prey. Gone every morsel.
All right, more gull talk. Mm-hmm. I'm loving it. I won't lie. What mm-hmm. do you think about this?
Yeah, it's straightforward.
This
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
I imagine this could be you. You would buy cakes for the purpose of giving them to the gulls.
Creatures, or well, our ducks in Arklow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep, yep.
I've done that.
I noticed when I was reading this the word serried, which is a word that I pretty much only know from Ulysses. It means rows of people or things standing close together.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of echoes Dan Dawson's speech in Aeolus. You remember Dan Dawson's?
Mm.
Doughy Dan?
Yeah.
Doughy Daw or whatever they're called. Yep. Or again, if we but climb the serried mountain peaks. And so I think Bloom heard that speech and that word stuck in his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's showing up here. Yeah. The glazed apple serried on her stand.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little callback
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Aware of their greed and cunning, he shook the powdery crumb from his hands. They never expected that. Manna. Live on fish. Fishy flesh they have, all seabirds, gulls, sea goose. Swans from Analiffy swim down here sometimes to preen themselves. No accounting for tastes. Wonder what kind is swan meat. Robinson Crusoe had to live on them. They wheeled, flapping weakly. I'm not going to throw any more. Penny quite enough. A lot of thanks I get, not even a caw. They spread foot and mouth disease too. If you cram a turkey, say on chestnut meal, it tastes like that. Eat pig like pig. But then why is it that saltwater fish are not salty? How is that?
Any thoughts on Bloom's thoughts?
Yeah, it's just like regular. Yeah, it all makes sense. Like, I'm not seeing any cryptic, obviously, manna, a biblical thing. We're like still like feeding off the Elijah ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, we discussed the birds and manna in the previous episode yeah. and their relation to
seagulls,
Elijah.
Like, of all the birds are fairly, they eat pretty much, but the seagulls in particular are just ravenous. Like,
it's seagulls like are scavengers. Not yeah. all birds will eat anything but seagulls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we were in feeding the creatures down by the Avoca River in Arklow that one time, you could throw the crumbs up into the air and the mm-hmm. gulls will just pick them out of the air. Yep. Like the acrobatics and mm-hmm. the skill they have to go,
yep.
to see the trajectory of that thing and just pluck it out of the sky. And these are creatures that have evolved to like dive, I guess, into the water to mm-hmm. pick fish out. And it's like there's no bother to them at all. Mm-hmm. They learned that skill very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
People throwing it up into the sky. So mm-hmm. yeah, phenomenal. Yeah. That's how I would feed them. I would throw it up and just to see the thing rather than throw it into the water. But yeah. he's not thinking of that.
Yeah. yeah. I like the image too of he throws them in and all the seagulls come yeah. and you can hear them in your mind. Okay. So we're at the last little bit here where we're going to really kick off and start talking about stuff.
His eyes sought answer from the river and saw a rowboat rock at anchor on the treacly swells lazily its plastered board. Keynotes, 11 shillings. Trousers.
Okay.
Reader or listener, we will now speak about these 4 words for the yeah. next hour.
Yeah, yeah, that's our show. There is actually one more paragraph under this. We're also going to talk about anti-syphilitic drugs.
Great.
So
can't have enough of them.
Actually, I think they are anti-clap. And clap, I always get wrong. Is clap syphilis or gonorrhea?
Gonorrhea, I think.
Okay. If I've got the clap wrong, let me know if it's syphilis or gonorrhea. They're so focused on syphilis in this era, though, that...
Oh, it's horrendous. Horrific
yeah.
disease.
Yeah.
In the early stages, it's lovely. because it just eats a little bit of your brainstem and gives you permanent euphoria. And so it's believed Nietzsche, in one of the last books that he wrote, he described this wonderful golden autumn and he was in pure bliss. And it sounds very much like that initial stage of syphilis, just eating his brain. And then, of course, it just destroys what's left. They think. They never know what I'm digging them up for, I guess.
I was reading the Oliver St. John Gogarty play Blight. And there's a woman in it who's a sex worker. And Medical Dick and Medical Davy are discussing that she has a sore on her lip. Oh. And I thought, oh, they're saying she has herpes. But it was syphilis.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, there was just one STD everybody was really worried about back then. Now we have a wonderful variety that we might get.
Yeah, but we have treatment protocols too. Yeah. They didn't have antibiotics.
Syphilis was king. Yeah. So it's like anything that went wrong in that department was. So that's why I think the clap might be syphilis and not gonorrhea. And then as syphilis went out of fashion.
The matter user has like just
a euphemism
STI. For something's down there not working right.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, that ends sexually transmitted disease and infection talk. Yes. So let's move on to Leopold Bloom's philosophy of advertising. Bloom lays out his philosophy of advertising in the Ithaca episode, which we will not read until like 10 years from now, probably. So let's look on it now. All right, do you know anything about Ithaca, Dermot? In the context of Ulysses, the penultimate chapter of Ulysses.
Oh, that's the Molly Bloom soliloquy?
No, this is...
Oh, but that's the second last one.
Yeah, that's the one that everyone likes. Yeah. Ithaca's the one that if you like it, you have to defend that you like it. Because it's good in its way, but it's written as in the style of the catechism. So it's all question and answer.
Right. Yep.
So Bloom poses the question, what also stimulated him in his cogitations? And it's written in that style of language. Then he goes on and describes the qualities of an ideal advertisement.
One of my old school teachers from County Monaghan said that word is advertisement, which always amused
us. Okay. Did you say advertisement?
Advertisement, advertisement. But I never would have thought advertisement.
Well, if you're from the County Monaghan, we want to know, do you say advertisement?
Leave your comments.
Leave a comment below. I'm trying to engagement farm a little bit.
The infinite possibilities hitherto unexploited of the modern art of advertisement, if condensed in triliteral mono-ideal symbols, vertically of maximum visibility, divined, horizontally of maximum legibility, deciphered, and of magnetizing efficacy to arrest involuntary attention, to interest, to convince, to decide.
Okay, so that's an ideal advertisement.
Yeah.
Basically, it should be easy to see, easy to read, and... quote, arrest the involuntary attention. It grabs your attention. As I'd say it's pretty basic. So in Ithaca, Bloom gives some examples of good and bad advertising. And his primary example of this ideal ad is that Kino's 11 shilling trousers ad on the rowboat. Because then he poses a question, such as? And the answer is K11, Kino's 11 shilling trousers. He also lists out several unsuccessful ads, chief among them Plumtree's Potted Meat, which we'll get a further, you know, analysis from Bloom on much later in the episode once he makes it to Davy Burns. We'll return to Kino's in just a moment, but I want us to just cogitate, increase our cogitation of Bloom's ideas just a bit further. So, like I said, these principles seem pretty basic, to be honest. Like, they would be the things you learn on day one of advertisement school, if there is such a thing. However, at the turn of the 20th century and the Victorian into Edwardian era, these were some fairly innovative ideas. Victorian ads were often packed with tiny expository text and sometimes no image at all, which is really hard to imagine because ads nowadays are mostly image and maybe no text at all. It was thought during the Victorian era that ads should rely on appeals to reason. I know, right?
Jeez.
Stating the case for why their product should be chosen over competitors and listing information like prices and hard evidence of the product's efficacy. So Bloom in Ithaca also gives some ad copy for a candle. And so it's an example of this kind of ad. Do you want to read his candle ad copy there?
Look at this long candle. Calculate when it burns out and you receive gratis one pair of our special non-comparable boots. Guaranteed one candle power. Address, Barclay and Cook, 18 Talbot Street.
And when we say ad copy, what is it? If someone's not familiar with that.
I'm assuming that means the text on the
ad. Yeah. So I went and looked up some historic advertisements, and I just want you to, you don't have to read all the copy on it because it's just copy, but it's three different ads, yeah. And I just want you to describe it, and then we'll put it either in the video or in the show notes for our listeners.
Yeah, the top one that jumps out, because they've done something fancy with the text, it's curved. Melon's food for infants and invalids. Melon's food biscuits, digestive, oh, nourishing, biscuits. Sustaining. For children after weaning, the aged, dyspeptic, and for all who require a simple, nutritious, and sustaining food.
I hate to interrupt. You're doing a great job reading. I don't want to linger on this too long, yes. But the middle ad is really the most interesting.
I'll skip the Beetham's glycerin and cucumber, which sounds yummy.
Oh, every ad on this page is just it's just like it was made by aliens for humans.
The middle one, or an AI. Oh, maybe these were made by a super intelligent AI from the future. They went back in time
the
to destroy
the middle his. One's the best one. Read the middle one.
Epsis cocaine. Cocoa nib extract. Tea-like.
And cocaine.
A thin beverage of full flavor. Now with many beneficially taking the place of tea. Its active principle being a gentle nerve stimulant supplies the needed energy without unduly exciting the system. Sold in packets and tins by grocers labelled James Epps & Co. Limited, homeopathic chemists, London.
So, and part of the reason that one really jumps out, as would any veteran Ulysses readers, as you know, in that Ithaca episode, Bloom and Stephen sit down and share some Epps' cocoa together. Mm-hmm. Which, when I saw this, I was like, were they like doing rails in the Bloom's kitchen? was it cocoa? And it's really cocaine?
I think there was cocaine in it. But it might not have been. They said homeopathic. It might have been a trace amount.
I don't know. It's just like, maybe it's another product offered by the Epps company.
A little tiny microdose of cocaine probably is not going to wreck
you. Don't think they were like emptying out the tin and, you know.
No, they were grinding it up.
Were they doing it off the keys? And Bloom's like, fuck, I lost my key. Like, I left my keys in the other trousers. Yeah. I can't key the Epsis cocaine.
We don't have credit cards yet. Somebody invent credit cards.
Sorry.
No.
I clap when I laugh sometimes. I don't mean to make such a loud sound.
Look, I'm serious. Like, a little microdose of that will probably give you half an hour.
Gentle nerve stimulate. They're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to write those alphabet books. Start with C.
No. Start with Z. Work backwards.
Okay, so these are all 19th century sales tactics. And Bloom is a 20th century man. Mm-hmm. Bloom is living in a time of transition into a new age of advertising. If only he can get the conservative old men he works for to listen. Look.
You gotta wait for them to die.
You have to talk to them after they've had their whiskey, not before. That is his mistake. Mm-hmm. He can't help but feel that a more modern approach to advertising has not been, quote, hitherto exploited by Dublin's ad men. And we'll get into his beef with Healy's in an upcoming episode with Wisdom Healy. He has he has more beef than with Miles Crawford, his current employer. James Joyce did share Bloom's passion for ads and naturally was well-read on the subject. Scholar Sabrina Alonso points out Joyce's interest in a book called Advertising or The Art of Making Known, which is a 1910 by Howard Bridgewater that focuses on then-current psychological concepts and how they could be used to advertise. Bridgewater's approach focused more on playing to, quote, human volition, and relying on emotional appeals rather than rational appeals. And I would say that emotional appeal would dominate our current ideas about advertising. Definitely the Edward Bernays era that would be right on the heels of Howard Bridgewater.
Yeah.
So in Ulysses, the plum tree's potted meat ad is a great example of this tactic, though maybe not a successful one. Although, I mean, Boylan bought the plum tree's potted meat, so maybe it's just not successful to Bloom. Mm. But it ties potted meat to the idea of domestic bliss. So when you buy plum tree's potted meat, you're really buying that emotion, perhaps even a desire for future bliss or a nostalgia for bygone days of bliss. There's no logical reason to ever purchase plum tree's potted meat is kind of what I'm driving at here. Bloom doesn't like the plum tree's ad campaign, like I mentioned, but he has his own emotional baggage, so it's not working for him. Poor plum trees gets listed in Ithaca under, quote, such as never in his assessment of advertising. such as never. That's when I buy Plumtree's potted meat. He's getting kind of sassy there, and I like it. Joyce felt that typical advertising posters were too static to really be effective. In keeping with this idea, many of the ads that catch Bloom's eye in Lestergonians are in motion. So the Elijah throwaway is thrust into his hand by a proselytizer in motion. The Kino's rowboat bobs on the Liffey, and when we get to those Healy's sandwichmen, which Bloom also doesn't like due to emotional baggage, they kind of trundle their way down Westmoreland Street. And we'll see some of Bloom's other advertising ideas as we move through this episode. In a grander sense, their, quote, efficacy to arrest involuntary attention is strengthened by the motion, right? That's one of those important three components. They're maximally visible and legible, though Bloom approves of Kino's ad placement much more so than, again, those Healy sandwichmen, who are maximally visible, but somewhat less legible when they fall out of sync with one another. Mm. Many of these ads also promise a renewal or transformation. We're kind of getting into our Ulysses themes here, both in a religious sense, you know, with that Elijah throwaway, and in a faux religious sense with that Plumtree's potted meat. We did a full episode about Plumtree's potted meat. It's back in our Lotus Eaters episode. Go find it there. Kino's and Healy's make less explicit claims, but perhaps a passerby can fill in the gaps with their own imagination about how a nice pair of slacks or a top-notch set of stationery could really transform one's life. And finally, we must keep in mind Joyce's sense of humor when approaching these ads, because that is something that falls through the cracks in a lot of scholarship and discussion. We're reading a serious book, so we must be serious. But that's why I put that quote at the beginning there from Daniel Gunn, is a lot of this is meant to be silly. Like, it's meant to be funny. Mm-hmm. He's getting so hung up on this rowboat ad. Humor is a common tactic in advertising, as it's a good way to draw people in and make the ad sticky. If an ad's sticky, what does sticky mean?
It stays in your memory.
That's right.
It lands on you, yeah.
Yeah, you got it. Such ad slogans can be repeated infinitely as shorthand for larger concepts. A lowbrow method to draw our attention to higher concepts. Mm-hmm. Consider the way Bloom drops the Pear's soap slogan into his stream of consciousness back in Lotus Eaters while talking to Bantam Lions. It's just in there. Good morning, have you used Pear soap? It just drops right in there. And it's a humorous way for Bloom to propose a solution to Bantam's poor hygiene. So he's saying it again in a sassier way. Good morning, if you used Pear soap. Bleh. But it can also communicate to us as well Bloom's desire to have his own bath at the Turkish Baths, which he's moving towards with that lemon soap that he just bought. It also taps into period anxieties about cleanliness in class. We did a whole episode about this also back in those Lotus Eater series, so go find that in the podcast feed there. And finally, this reference to Pear soap can also hint at metaphoric moral dirt caused by Bloom's little epistolary affair with one Martha Clifford. Mm. And it's also racist. The Pear soap ads from that period are very racist. So there's also this colonial domination, things like that. It's a lot in that silly little Pear slogan. And that's how slogans work. You pack a lot into very little. The ads that Bloom encounters in Lestergonians also embody the sense of ludicrousness, even though they transform into literary motifs in the pages of Ulysses. Elijah is coming only seems like a straightforward religious decree until you learn all that stuff about the real-life huckster John Alexander Dowie posing as Elijah. It takes on a new dimension having that knowledge, which is why we talk about it, not just because it's a fun story. Mm-hmm. Let's give the Kino's 11 shilling trousers ad the Elijah and Pear soap treatment. Let's talk about it for way too long and analyze it way too much.
Good.
Because that's what we're all here for. The Kino's rowboat is successful in Bloom's mind first and foremost because of its motion. It rocks up and down. It goes back and forth in the flowing stream of life, the River Liffey. Mm-hmm. All right. Do you know the Irish name for the Liffey? Liffey is L-I-F-F-E-Y, is anglicized. Mm-hmm. It's in Irish, it's Lifa, and it's L-I-F-E.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh. It doesn't mean life. Like, there's a different word in Irish for life, but it looks like life, so it's the river of life.
Okay.
You know, so that probably means nothing here. We can just ignore it. Mm. The bobbing motion of this rowboat, though, is enough to grab the attention of anyone glancing over the side of the O'Connell Bridge, right? That's what happened to Bloom. Mm. He went there for another purpose, to feed the seagulls and kill some time, and he ends up thinking about this 11 shilling trousers ad. It's more effectively navigates the stream of life as it rolls with the waves and current, rather than being dragged along involuntarily like that crumpled Elijah throwaway. And it's because the robot's anchored. It's not just hanging out down there, it's anchored. Mm. In the book, The Economy of Ulysses by Mark Austin, one of my very favorite books about Ulysses, Austin writes,
"Because it is displayed on water, the Kino's ad is not stationary. Its power to arrest attention, to make the viewer pause, paradoxically depends upon its wave-like motion. Up and down, back and forth, the ad is anchored, yet always moving, its magnetism resulting from its imitation of the stream of life that constantly repeats, yet always changes."
Okay. Furthermore, Bloom's momentary pondering of the Kino's ad deepens and expands the water motif already present in Ulysses. Talked about that a lot in Proteus, but it's you'll find it throughout the book. We see the power and wildness of the stream of consciousness that Bloom has tapped into. He will literally, you know, mention the stream of life and whatnot in the next paragraph we're going to look at here. And this stream has no master. You must master the stream, lest it master you.
Mm.
It's all rolled up in this cozy absurdity that we were led to these insights by an ad for trousers. Delighted by the unexpected placement of the Kino's ad, Bloom thinks of the possibilities of novel ad spaces. Look, you live in a modern city, there's ads everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can't escape.
Yeah. Good idea that. Wonder if he pays rent to the corporation. How can you own water, really? It's always flowing in a stream, never the same, which in the stream of life we trace, because life is a stream. All kinds of places are good for ads. That quack doctor for the clap used to be stuck up in all the greenhouses. Never see it now. Strictly confidential. Dr. High Franks. Didn't cost him a red like the Magini, the dancing master self-advertisement. Got fellows to stick them up, or stick them up himself for that matter, on the QT, running in to loosen a button. Fly by night. Just the place to. Post no bills. Post 110 pills. Some chap with a dose burning him. If he... Oh, eh? No. I don't believe it. He wouldn't surely. No.
What do you think?
Some of that's kind of hard to parse now, but obviously he's asking, is the advertiser with the boat, how did he get that by the corporation? Because even then there was the corporation who would have...
Well, Kino has his rowboat down there. He's wondering, does he pay rent to put that boat there?
Because there's nothing stopping somebody else from putting the boat in the Liffey, and the whole Liffey's full of boats with bloody ads on them. It'd be an eyesore. So I wonder how long he was able to pull that one off. Mm-hmm. Because corporations going to go, yeah, that's not on. We just pass an ordinance and you can't do that anymore. So the quack doctor for the clap. So he's talking about this Dr. High Franks who used to put ads all over the greenhouses. What's a greenhouse in this context?
An outhouse.
Ah, okay.
The jacks.
Ah, okay. So that's not a garden center.
No.
Okay.
They put him over, you know, well, it wouldn't be urinals, I suppose, but they put him where you're mm-hmm. going to, he's going to have a captive audience for a minute or so.
Yeah. Didn't cost him a red. It's like a red penny or a red cent. Is that the reference there? Like McGinney, whoever he is, the dancing master.
He'd be McGinney.
Okay. He got fellas to stick him up for himself on the QT, running in to loosen the button. Loosen the button for the urination. Mm-hmm. That's the flyby night. Okay, fly. Is that a trouser fly, I'm
sure. Sure.
Post no bills. Post 110 pills.
See, if you put stickers over some of the post no bills.
You can hide the no bills and put the 110 pills over it.
Yeah.
Okay. Some chap with a dose burning him. Oh, dear God. And then he thinks, so he's thinking about Blaze's boiling.
Yes.
Does Blaze's boiling have something contagious because he's a dirty fecker?
And then he says, he wouldn't, surely. And the implication is, would he give it to Molly?
Mm.
And then Bloom says, no. And he, you know, pushes it out of his mind.
Yeah.
Yes, the charlatan Dr. High Franks advertises for treatment of the clap, which we think is syphilis. I have in my notes gonorrhea, but I thought about it more just in the interval here. Ooh. It's probably syphilis given the era, and it's probably something less nice than a urinal, but a captive audience nonetheless. Bloom is amused by this unorthodox ad campaign, and its memory shakes loose, fear in his mind that, you know, maybe Boylan give Molly some kind of infection. Once Bloom shakes free of this momentary panic, Dr. Franks has been pushed from his mind entirely and will be replaced by refreshingly unsexy thoughts of parallax and Dunsink time.
Good.
Which we'll cover in our next episode. Dr. Franks's ad has only gone dormant in Bloom's subconscious, though, as it resurfaces later in Circe, now merged with the Kino's ad.
The fly bill. K11, post no bills, strictly confidential, Dr. High Franks.
Yeah, so that's, it's written as a script, so the flybill is the character, and that's its line of dialogue. It's a speaking flybill.
Okay.
Transformed into an emblem of Bloom's sexual anxieties, Dr. Franks reflects Bloom's sexual misdeeds more than you might think. High Franks and Henry Flower share initials, after all.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Henry Flower?
That's his pen name. That's for his, right. Yeah.
Yep. And High is a sort of a shortening or a nickname for Henry.
Mm.
So he's probably Dr. Henry Franks to his mother.
Right.
The once delightful Kino's 11 shilling trousers have been condensed to K11.
Mm.
K11. And like Dr. High Franks, K11 has absorbed some of Bloom's anxiety. K11 actually precedes the Kino's rowboat by two episodes in Ulysses the novel. Towards the end of Hades, as Bloom tries to figure out where McIntosh has disappeared to, a half-remembered fragment of a song lyric pops into his mind. Do you remember the song? K-E-double-L-Y. Oh, yeah. God. But he just says K-E-double-L-Kel. All right?
Yeah.
That's my name. With a little massaging, this can become K-11. The double L looks like the number 11. What about that E? That's kind of where the trick is. Scholar Robert Adams points out that K-11 can be a reference to the Kabbalah, and that this combination of letter and number symbolizes resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Once Kabbalah is in the mix, we can graft Hebrew spelling rules onto this phrase and suppress that vowel entirely. Thus, we get K-11, a symbol of resurrection, renewal, or something darker tucked into a trousers ad.
At the risk of gazumping you, mm-hmm. K is the 11th letter of the alphabet.
Oh, okay, cool. I didn't have that.
So it's 11-11.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's a special number.
Mm-hmm.
All right, K-11 goes quiet for a while before resurfacing again in Circe as an answer to a question.
Chris Callanan, what is the parallax of the subsolar ecliptic of Aldebaran? Bloom, pleased to hear from you, Chris. K-11.
What do you think? You're okay. You're like a space nerd. This is Dermot talk here.
Yeah, I don't know the parallax of stars though. Like that's like hardcore nerd. Even like at the time when when the astronomer at Dunsink was, somebody said, yeah, his work was just like, you know, like very, so just technical. It wasn't breakthrough, but it's important. But it's the kind of stuff that like astronomers value highly, but it's not like the theory of relativity.
Okay, well, K-11 here is mixed in with a couple of important details for our purposes as literary people. Just as when it's associated with Dr. High Franks, it all kind of points to Bloom's sexual anxiety. So I just thought too, Franks is another word for hot dogs, which is a phallic symbol. Is Dr. Franks, is he a phallic symbol? In the scene, Chris Callanan is asking Bloom about the parallax of the star. Is it Aldebaran?
Aldebaran.
Yeah. Aldebaran?
No, Aldebaran.
Aldebaran?
It's from Arabic, right?
Okay.
I'm sure the Arabic pronunciations are different. But,
okay. Well,
it's one of many stars with an Arabic name because medieval Europeans were not up to snuff at the time.
It's just the sort of question to delight Bloom's inner science geek.
Mm.
Some, I think you'll find Bloom very relatable in this fashion.
Mm.
Luckily, Bloom has the answer in his back pocket to Chris Callanan's very out-of-pocket question. It's K-11. Of course it's K-11. Who the heck is Chris Callanan, you might be asking?
Yes. Yeah.
I think if you've read the entirety of Ulysses 3, you'd be forgiven for not remembering Chris Callanan. But to get this answer, we must turn to the 10th episode of Ulysses, which is Wandering Rocks, where Callanan appears in a story courtesy of Lenihan, who, as always, is being just the worst. Lenihan is regaling McCoy with the time he shared a car home from a fancy dinner in Glen Cree with the Blooms and Chris Callanan. So it's the four of them. There's two Blooms, Callanan and Lenihan. Bloom and Callanan were on one side, Molly and Lenihan are on the other. And Bloom was eagerly kind of pointing out the window at various stars, constellations, to Chris Callanan. They're talking about the stars. Meanwhile, Lenihan, who is seated next to Molly, who has had a little too much to drink, and in Lenihan's own words,
by God, I was lost, so to speak, in the Milky Way.
Yeah. So what emerges then in Bloom's subconscious in Circe is the memory of feeling like a fool for pointing out stars like an eager grade school student while another man is groping his wife across the carriage and he didn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible. It must be an awful feeling. Both Lenihan and Callanan are listed on Bloom's list of men he suspects Molly of having relations with. However, we're defining that. It's not clear to me whether or not Bloom is actually slut-shaming Molly here, or he's just painfully aware of how many other men have made moves on her, sometimes right in front of him, which I imagine is humiliating. It's common enough for a woman to be blamed for an assault perpetrated against her, as it is here. Molly makes it clear in Penelope, she remembers what is a sexual assault against her by Lenihan, and that she, it's not a fond memory for her. So what's not clear to me is if Bloom is blaming her. I start getting into the weeds here. I think he just feels humiliated due to Lenihan's brazen disrespect of both him and Molly. So turning back to Kino's trousers, Kino isn't the only 11 shilling trouser man in town. We learned in Hades that Bloom's tailor is not Kino, but it's one Mr. George Messias. Do you remember Messias the tailor?
No.
No, of course not. Later in Sirens, though, we learn that Messias is also seeing other people, so to speak. Here's a quote from Sirens.
A young gentleman, stylishly dressed in an indigo blue serge suit made by George Robert Messias, tailor and cutter of number 5 Eden Key, and wearing a straw hat, very dressy, bought of John Plasto of number 1 Great Brunswick Street, Hatter.
Who do you think that is? You recently drew a little caricature of a man in a handsome indigo blue serge suit with a little straw hat on top.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, the flashy guy.
Blazes Boylan.
Blazes Boylan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but doesn't Stephen wear a straw hat, though, right? But all the people on Bloomsday who wear straw hats, are they all dressing as Blazes?
Joyce wore the boater. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not the Joyce and not Blazes Boylan. Yeah. Okay.
They didn't go to Plasto's high-grade hat. There's also noticed, too, he has a very dressy hat from John Plasto. Bloom's hat is also from Plasto's, but it's old because inside the band it says Plasto's high grade hat because the T's been worn away.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
He's not going to get his suit repaired by George Messias, because I think Bloom talks about getting his suit turned by Messias, which means he's getting it kind of patched up.
Okay. Yeah.
Boylan is wearing a fresh made suit from Messias. Mm-hmm. Right? So Bloom goes there for I think the implication is that Bloom goes there to get his old clothes fixed. Boylan goes there to get his clothes made. Mm. You know, you see the difference?
Yep.
Messias is also made the suit, okay, that Boylan is wearing to meet Molly that very day. That's what's being described there. In Circe, we learn the price of a pair of Messias's trousers.
Messias, to alteration, one pair trousers, 11 shillings.
Kino's obviously are lower grade trousers because they can be bought for 11 shillings. Mm-hmm. Messias's can only be altered for 11 shillings.
Right.
So he's a better tailor. Messias can also mean Messiah, but it would seem there is no resurrection or renewal. Ah. For Bloom and Messias's 11 shilling trousers either. As Austin points out, Messias has altered more than just Bloom's trousers. He has indirectly altered Bloom's marriage. Bloom must take up the mantle of savior, which he does for Stephen while settling his bill in Bellacoen's. 11 shillings in total. Austin writes,
11 shillings will buy you new trousers or alter your old ones. It might also save you from Circe.
So that is the story of Kino's 11 shilling trousers. Hmm. Anything you want to add there?
Lots of numerology, though. Mm-hmm. Like, and Joyce had a fixation on 11.
Joyce dug numerology in general, yeah.
Yeah. Whether he believed it was real or not, he's still like playing with all the number games.
I think he definitely put stock into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he'd like make life decisions based on it, but it was interesting to him. And it was, I think, symbolically useful the way the other correspondences are.
Yeah.
So when you say believe, I think that's more. I'm assuming that's what you're driving at.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
How many shillings did your trousers cost?
Yeah, like I got most of my clothing from that shop. It's a Wrap in Burbank. I think it's on Lancashire. And because the different TV productions and movie productions stop, they wrap and then they just dump their entire wardrobe on it. So you can get crazy clothes for like diddly. So I would get like a coat worth $400 for 40. And, you know, they have to get rid of them. They have a small space. So if you're in the area and you want to look good for maybe not much money, then you go in there, buy stuff and laugh. And if I ever get back to LA, I am going there.
All right. And that is what we call in the business. A free advertisement. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think advert is time to end this episode.
Okay.
All right. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.
See you then.